Good evening, everyone. This week's Parsha is Parsha Shmos, Tav Shin Pei. We will begin from the beginning. Page 292. Page 292, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph. Chapter 1, verse 1. Ve'ela Shmos b'nei Yisrael haba'im Mitzrayma. And these are the names of the sons of Yisrael that came to Egypt. Es Yaakov, with Yaakov, Ishave Seivo, a man in his household, they came. So we're going to begin with discussing the very first letter of the parasha, the Ela, Vav, and these. When you have a Vav at the beginning, that typically means that it's connecting to what was previous. It's making a connection between what was previous and now. So what is that connection of the Vav? So the Aruch Chaim has a number of explanations. One explanation that he has is that it says the Ela but Tosefes Vav, the word Ve'ela with the addition of the Vav, Lulmayr Aleyem Kikulam Tzadikim Kaveiseyem, that all those mentioned this week's Parsha were righteous as their forefathers were. Ve'ela Maisef Alarishonim, the word Ve'ela is always saying that we are continuing, we are adding on to what was before, continuing with from before. Ma'arishonim Lahem Avnitzach V'yakayim Tzadikim Elyonim, just like the earlier ones, those that were mentioned in the previous parsha, Ad Mitzlach and Yaakov, they were tremendous tzaddikim. Kamaisa Abbas Asa Rabbanim, the children followed in the footsteps of their ancestors. So Ve'ela is teaching us that the same right, that the same way Ad Mitzlach and Yaakov were very highly righteous individuals, these children, these grandchildren that are now entering Eretz Yisrael were also highly righteous. Or another way of explaining the connection between the previous and now, meaning we're making a connection between the previous, the book of Bereishis, and now the beginning of Shemos. So the first connection is, just like those mentioned in Bereishis were tremendously righteous, those mentioned here are also very, very righteous. Another connection is the following, and that is that we know that Hashem told Avraham by Rizpah Nebusarim that his children would be exiled for how many years? 400 years. We know in Egypt how many years were they actually there? 210. So where do you get your 400 from? The answer is, it comes from the birth of Yitzchak. And therefore, Kizman Agolas Hischa Mimei Avraham Mishanayla Yitzchak. The connection is actually now coming from a different direction, starting from here. The first explanation says, look at Bereishis, and from Bereishis we understand to Shemos. Those mentioned in Bereishis were highly righteous. Those mentioned in Shemos are also highly righteous. Now we're going the other direction. Now in Shemos we talk about the enslavement of the Jewish people, and we say the Vav that connects to before is really telling us that the same way there is a fulfillment of the decree happening here in Shemos, the fulfillment already began before in Bereishis, starting from the birth of Yitzchak.
He lived 180 years?
Who?
Yitzchak.
Gets 180 years.
So if you take out from 400, he passed away when they were going in, right? When they were going to the Messiah. If they were there 400 years, take away 180 at birth. So that only leaves 220.
So that leaves 220.
So,
okay.
So the first 7 years of.
So that means he died 20 years before they left.
Right.
Because you were there for 210, which is not that difficult because the Medrash says when Yosef was sold, Yitzchak was still alive.
And the 210 counts the good years too.
Yeah, the years in Egypt.
Indeed.
But the point is that now the Vav connecting is saying that what we find in Shemos, which is the fulfillment of the decree of the enslavement and the exile of 400 years, that already started from before. That's the Vav. That's the connection between the two. That's how the two come together. The enslavement that we see in Shemos already began in Bereishis. Oid Yirtzeh. Now, another thing that he says, another way of, again, connecting the two, and again, now we're going to the direction of Bereishis to Shemos, Maharishonim Yadu V'Hikiru B'Golus, just as the early ones, meaning Avnitzach and Yaakov, knew and recognized the fact that there would be a exile of their children, V'Kiblu Aleihem V'Alzarim, and they accepted upon themselves and their children, K'moy Kein Eile, so to these, meaning Avnitzach and Yaakov understood that starting that Avram received a prophecy, Brith Ben Abasarim, which said their children will be in Golis for 400 years. And they, as the great people they were, they knew it, they accepted it, and they accepted it on themselves and their children. They understood this is the will of Hashem. One might think that the later generations weren't so willing to accept it. They had no choice. They didn't willingly accept it. And therefore, the vav that connects is saying, just like Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov willingly accepted what Hashem had decreed upon their children, the children themselves, even as they entered Egypt, they themselves willingly accepted whatever Hashem was going to bring upon them and their generations. And therefore, with that, he explains the question. What are the questions that the famous Rashi asks this question? And that is, you know, why are we going through all the names? We know all these names from before. Why do we have to repeat the names of Yaakov who came down from Egypt? So Rashi has his explanation. And the Arachaim says, the explanation is the following. If the point of Ve'ela is to say the connecting Vav and the word Ve'ela, which means we're adding on to what was before. If we're going to say that the point of that is to say that these generations going into Egypt willingly accept whatever Hashem was bringing upon them in the exile. So the Torah actually wants to go through their names to actually give full credit to each one. Not just the fact that Ve'ela, the Vav, we're going to bring out this idea that there is a continuation from before to now, but being that it's there to praise them for the fact that they willingly accepting upon themselves the decree of Hashem for exile, and they're willing to accept it and go through it to fulfill the will of Hashem, the Torah wants to give them the credit of enumerating each one of their names to say each one of them, each and every one of them accepted Hashem's decree of exile and enslavement on themselves and the children. So these are the way this is the Arachaim's explanation as to Ve'ela, the connecting, and these are all the ideas that lie behind that connection between the Sefer Bereishis and Sefer Shmos. It's being alluded to in the Ve'ela and these. Okay, let's move on. Now, the next point that I want to share with you is from Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch focuses on the words. It says, Ve'ela Shmais B'nai Yisrael B'mitzrayim. These are the names of the children of Israel that came to Egypt. Eis Yaakov, with Yaakov, Ish Ubeis Rebo, a man and his house they came. What exactly is the Torah trying to impart to us with that phrase, Ish Ubeis Rebo, a man and his family they came? What's he trying to tell us with that? So we know that they came with their families. I mean, we know that from previously. What's the point of that here? So Rav Hirsch explains that we know that when the Jewish people are going to be redeemed, they're going to leave Egypt. Before they leave Egypt, they're going to bring a Korban Pesach, a Paschal sacrifice. And that Korban Pesach is going to be given, is going to be an obligation of Seh Lebeis Avos, Seh Lebeis, a lamb for family, a lamb per home. Rav Hirsch says the focus that the Korban Pesach has to be per family, per home, is actually, and let me read it to you, the call of God was to arise to immortal life. God began building up of his people on the rock-like foundation of homes, on the bond of children to parents and parents to children. That is what Seh Lebeis Avos Seh Lebeis. The whole idea of a lamb, of the sacrifice to a household, meant to create the foundation of the Jewish people, which is what is the bedrock of the Jewish people, the Jewish home. And that was being stressed as the Jewish people were being created. The Korban Pesach was the beginning of the Jewish people, the beginning of their redemption, and in that redemption Hashem set up Seh Lebeis Avos Seh Lebeis, a lamb per home, a lamb per family, that there is a focus, there has to be a focus on the family, because the family is the foundation of the Jewish people. And here we are told that this basic foundation of the immortal people of God was implanted in them when the children of Israel originally moved down into Egypt, out of which, through suffering and woe, they were born as a nation. This idea of the importance of family, of connection between parent and child, child to parent, was already a part of the Jewish people when they came down to Egypt. Hashem stressed it, and Hashem made it part of the mitzvah, and Hashem stressed it as they were leaving Egypt, but it was already an idea implanted in them before, when they first came down to Egypt. It was manifest when they first came down to Egypt. Why is that? Because it says, Eis Yaakov Ish Ubeisai. With Yaakov, a man in his home. A man in his home depicts that each one of Yaakov's sons were a man in his home. He had his own home. He had his own home. Each man had his own home and his own family. Independent, each one their own family. But they were Eis Yaakov. We translate Eis Yaakov as with Yaakov. Rav Hirsch points out, if the Torah doesn't say Im Yaakov, with Yaakov, it says the same idea, the same meaning, but the word Eis Yaakov. And he says, by using the word Eis Yaakov, that actually means that it's more than just with Yaakov. It's a very strong connection. It means connected to Yaakov. It means that each one, they came down to Egypt, although they were Ish Ubeisai, each one in his own household, but each one in his own household was with Yaakov. They were one with Yaakov. Yaakov was the stem, or the branch, and each one of them was a stem from that branch. They didn't see themselves as, sure, they're an individual family, I'm raising my own family, but each one is not completely independent of their father. They see themselves as a branch. They see themselves called a stem from the main branch of their father. That's Ishubei, Eis Yaakov Ishubeisai. Each one has his own family, but they are with Yaakov, they are connected to Yaakov. They established their own family with its own personality, with its own mission, but they understand that they're Eis Yaakov. They're not just completely on their own. They're connected to their father. So this entire idea of the family being not just some independent tribe that goes on its own, but rather a connection between parent and child, which is what Hashem was stressing by the Karban Pesach, by saying that the Karban Pesach has to be per family, per household, that idea of the connection between parent and child was already part of them as they came down to Egypt, as the Torah is depicting in Eis Yaakov, with Yaakov, Ishubei Seibo, with Yaakov, a man in his home they came. They came as families, each one of their own families, not just one big tribe, one big happy family. Each one has their own individual family. But they're with Yaakov, they're connected to Yaakov. They understand that they are forming off of Yaakov. And that they're not just going on their own, but they are continuing. You have the child and the parent. The parent looks to the child looks to the parent. And there's this continuum of parent and child that goes on for all generations. That's his thought on these words. Okay, now, let's move on.
Yosef was 30, and he passed away at 110. So all those years, they were living very well.
Who was it?
That was part of the 210, the Jews, they said.
No. Wait, no. What do you mean?
Do you think Yosef was alive when they started?
I'm not sure what you're asking.
Well, basically, he was 30 years old whenever he came to Egypt, right?
He was old. He was actually, by the time he came to Egypt, he was 37.
And he passed away at 110.
Passed away at 110.
So all the where were the Jews?
I can't go through that right now. Let's move on. Okay. Let's now look at. Let's continue on. Pasuk Beis. Reuven, and there now we go through the names. Reuven, Shimon, Levi, the Yehuda, Yisachar, Zebulun, and Binyamin, Dov, and Naphtali, Gad, VaAsher, VaYi Kol Nefesh Etzer, Yaakov, Shimon, Nefesh. All the souls that came from Yaakov, there were 70 souls. V'yosef v'yab in Mitzrayim, and Yosef was in Egypt. V'yamas Yosef v'chol Echav, and Yosef and all his brothers died, v'chol Adarahu and all that generation. V'vnei Yisrael paru v'yishritzu v'yarbu v'yatzmu v'ma'id ma'id, and the Jewish and B'nai Yisrael were fruitful, and they swarmed, and they increased, and they became strong, very strong, v'temilei aretz isam, and the land was filled with them. Now, on these words, where it says, after it says, the Pasuk Vav says, Yosef and all his brothers and another generation died. And the Jewish people increased and multiplied. And then Pasuk Ches talks about the new king that rose on Egypt. So the Medrash says on these words, and Yosef and all that generation died, the Medrash says, L'ametcha, this is to teach you, shekol zman shoye echad mehem kayim, me'oysen sherdel Mitzrayim, as long as any one of them that came down to Mitzrayim from Canaan were alive, le'shibdu ha'mitzvah b'Yisrael, the Egyptians did not enslave the Jewish people. Uvinei Yisrael paruva yishritzu. And then the next passage says the Jewish people multiplied and swarmed. Af al pishem Yosef ve'echav, even though Yosef and his brothers had died, Eloyeim lo meis, their God didn't die. Elo bnei Yisrael paruva yishritzu. The Jewish people continued to multiply in a miraculous manner. Yes, they may not have had those righteous individuals in their midst anymore. They may have had those kind of great individuals in their midst, but Hashem was still watching over them and blessing over them, and therefore they were multiplying. Okay? So Barry, touching on what you just kind of brought up, that until Yosef and his brothers and all that generation died, the Medrash says there was no enslavement.
Now,
210, not of enslavement, but at least of exile. Okay? Now, there is a question that actually we brought up last week that relates to this. If we look back to last week's Parsha, the very first Pasuk, page 268, Rashi points out, on the words by Achi Yaakov, look at that, we can look at, we'll review a Rashi we spoke about last week at length. By Achi Yaakov, the top Rashi on the right column, Lama Parsha Zu Stuma. We spoke about, if you look in the Sefer Torah, there is no break, there is no spacing between then the Vayikash and Mingin of Vayechi, it's closed up. So Lama Parsha Zu Stuma, the question is, why is this Parsha closed up? Why is it closed? Why is there no opening between it and the end of last week's Parsha? The Fishakema Shanifta Yaakov Avinu, because once Yaakov, our forefather, passed away, Nistabu Einayim V'Libam Shal Yisrael Mitzaras Hashibud. The eyes and the hearts of the Jewish people became closed up once Yaakov died from the suffering, from the distress of the enslavement. Shehizchilu L'Shablim, they began to enslave them. So Rashi seems to be saying that once Yaakov died, they began to enslave them. And the whole stima and the closing up between Parshas Vayechi and Parshas Vayigash is to bring out this idea: the closing of the Torah is meant to allude to a closing of the hearts and their minds that took place because of the shibud of the enslavement that began with the death of Yaakov. That seems to contradict this medrash that we just said. The medrash says that the enslavement didn't start until Yosef and everybody who came down from Egypt to begin with died. So how do we make the two things work together? So the Sifsei Chachamim, the commentary of Sifsei Chachamim Rashi in last week's parasha writes, Ratzalim, when Rashi says that their hearts and eyes became closed up from the enslavement because once Yaakov died, they began to enslave them, meaning, Shaloi ha-yolahem shibud mamish. They didn't have actual enslavement. Eletzaras ha-shibud. They had the distress of the enslavement. Shoyim avakish mayhem shayavduloi. Because once Yaakov died, that is when Paro, and that's when Egypt began asking them to start doing work. Kedarina b'soita b'perach b'perach, as the Gemara in Soita says about when the Torah describes that the Egyptians worked them b'perach, which in simple interpretation means hard labor. The Gemara says b'perach is actually a contraction of two words. B'farach is b'perach. A soft tongue. Because they started enslaving them in a, so to speak, nice way. Wouldn't you mind being a volunteer and a good supporter of the state by coming and helping us build these big cities? So, but the Jewish people apparently understood that this was the beginning of something, but it wasn't actual enslavement, but knowing that the enslavement was coming, that already brought them distress, and that distress closed up their hearts and their minds. So it's not a contradiction, according to Sifsei Chachamim. As the Medrash says in this week's Parsha, the actual enslavement did not start until Yosef and everyone who came down to Egypt died. But once Yaakov died, you already had the signs, of the slavery coming, because already started Sheshchilu L'Shabd, they began to enslave them. Rashi would mean, according to Sifsei Chachamim, not to enslave them, but they began to work them, which would eventually turn into the enslavement. The Jewish people realized that, and that distress caused their hearts and their minds to be closed up. But now, let's focus on that idea. What does it mean that their hearts and their minds became closed up? You know, we didn't discuss that last week. But now that we're bringing this up, about the idea that there's no contradiction to what Rashi says and what the Medrash this week's Parsha says. The idea that the enslavement was coming caused their hearts, their eyes, and their hearts to be closed up. What does that mean it caused their hearts and their eyes to be closed up. How do we explain that? Something about their perception, something about how they understood things, something got closed up. What exactly, is there a way we can identify what exactly went wrong? In what way did their hearts and their minds become closed up? So, I'd like to suggest the following explanation. And that explanation comes from the commentary of the Beis Halevi in this week's parsha. The Beis of this week's parsha, famous Beis Halevi, we mentioned a number of times, where he talks about the fact that there's a pasuk in Tillim that says, "Hafach libam lisnei oisam." Hashem turned the hearts of the Egyptians to hate the Jewish people. That's what it says. Hashem turned the hearts of the Egyptians against the Jewish people in Egypt. And the question is, why? Why did Hashem turn the hearts of the Egyptians against the Jewish people? You know, we're always talking about how the Egyptians went after us. It says, it's in Tillim, it seems to be that Hashem turned their hearts. Hashem caused the hearts of the Egyptians, or Hashem caused the Egyptians to hate them. Why was Hashem, so to speak, in whatever way it was, why was he egging on the Egyptians to hate us? What did we do wrong? Why did we deserve that? And not only that, when Tehillim says that, it says it as part of a chapter of Tehillim that's thanking Hashem for his kindnesses. How would we call this a kindness that Hashem turned the hearts of the Egyptians against the Jewish people? And he explains this because there is also a medrash that says that when the Jewish people were in Egypt, Heferu Brismila, they did not keep the covenant of circumcision, which we would understand simply to mean they stopped giving Brismila to their children. But the Beis Halevi, based on different proofs, says it can't be that they stopped giving a bris milah to their children, but rather they gave a bris milah to their children. But what they did is they covered it up. Basically, the way we do a bris milah now is we take off every bit of skin that's possible, which halachically you don't have to take off as much as we do, but we take it off to make sure that we get it right. But originally, when bris milah was done, the entire, all that skin was not necessarily taken off. And therefore, when the child first got their bris milah and the flesh was still pliable, so they used to basically stretch the flesh in a way that it would appear like a bris milah wasn't done. So the bris milah actually was done. Basically, he says they would never stop doing the one and only mitzvah that they had, but they covered it up. Because at the end of the day, what really stood out between them and the Egyptian was the fact was bris milah. It was something that was different in their bodies, and it was really the only mitzvah that they really had that differentiated them from the Egyptians. Theoretically, the Egyptians have to keep the seven Noahide laws just like the Jewish people do. So in that sense, there's no differentiation. The mitzvahs that have to be done when it comes to the seven Noahide laws, there's no difference between the Egyptians and Bnei Yisrael. The one mitzvah that differentiates them is milah. Avram Avinu was given a mitzvah bris milah. His descendants were obligated to do bris milah. The Egyptians weren't. The one thing, the one mitzvah that kept them apart from the Egyptians was bris milah. And as they realized that the enslavement was beginning, says the Beis Halevi, they became very frightened. You know, they became very frightened. How is it? They understood. Let me read to you his words. Raka inyan yuvan, this can be understood. That in Maseres HaYabiyadam, the Jewish people had a tradition. They have to remain in Egypt for 400 years as slaves. Once Yosef died, they knew the days of slavery were coming soon. And the exile will begin with that. And now the exile is beginning. They became very frightened and worried about their future. How would the Egyptians treat them and their children after such a long period of time and as slaves? They decided, you know what makes sense? It makes sense that we should be as similar to the Egyptians as possible. We should not stand out different from them. We should try as much as we can to be similar. They shouldn't stand out as strangers, as outsiders, as foreigners. Even though we know the Medrash says they kept their names, their dress code, but You know, basically, if the bodies are similar, the hearts will come close and the hatred will be less. So the whole idea was that by minimizing the difference between them and the Egyptians, that would be a way of basically tampering down the Egyptians' hatred for them. And the Baisalevi says that logically it makes sense. Logically, that makes sense. The more similar you are, the less hated you should be. Because it's different. People, when you're different, that's a reason for people to find a cause to hate you, especially in a situation where you're a foreigner and you look different and they're enslaving you at some degree. The best way to minimize the impact of the slavery would be the more similar they are, the more similar they are, the closer they'll be to them, the more similar they are, the friendlier they'll be to them, and that will minimize their stay, that minimize the possible suffering that they'd have while in Egypt. And as the Beis Halevi says, makes a lot of sense. But at the end of the day, says the Beis Halevi, the real difference between the Jewish people and the Egyptians was Bris Milah. That was the bottom line. That's the difference between them. And therefore, he says, even though what they did, as I described with the Bris Milah to cover it up, was not, they did not break halach in any way by doing that. Without the Bris Milah, what would happen to them? Without having that difference in their bodies between them and the Egyptians, if they're going to start coming closer to the Egyptians and more like by the Egyptians, what could happen? Assimilation would happen. Which is the opposite of the point of the mitzvah. The mitzvah point of the mitzvah Bris Milah itself is to separate us from the nations of the world. That's what it's meant to do. Every mitzvah is meant to make us separate. So now they have this one mitzvah by which they can be separate from the Egyptians. And what do they do? They're trying to undermine it. They're trying to basically take away the spirit of the mitzvah, the purpose of the mitzvah, the purpose of the mitzvah, but one of the main goals of the mitzvah, Bris Milah, which is to keep them separate from the other nations of the world. They're undermining that because they're trying, on the contrary, to cover it up, get closer to the Egyptians, which could actually foster assimilation. Therefore, what did Hashem do? Hafach libam lisnayosam. Hashem turned the hearts of the Egyptians against them. And we thank Hashem for it, because that's what prevented us from becoming assimilated.
That's the problem in America.
Right? By doing this, it saved us. And therefore, this was, said the Beis Halevi, this is what they were trying to do. They were not trying to stop in the mitzvah of Bris Milah. They were just trying to cover it up. The danger of that was wouldn't be enough separation between them, which could cause them to become assimilated. And therefore, Hashem went ahead and Hashem turned the hearts of the Egyptians against the Jewish people so that that wouldn't happen. Which sounds like from the Beis Halevi that, you know, there had to be an enslavement for 400 years. It could have maybe have been not as intense. It could have not have been as bad if the Jewish people wouldn't have made this mistake. If the Jewish people wouldn't have started trying to make themselves similar to the Egyptians so as to decrease the negativity of their stay in Egypt. If they wouldn't have made that mistake, they would have been enslaved. They would have fulfilled the decree, but there wouldn't have been that hatred or the same kind of hatred that they eventually turned into. This, perhaps, is what I'd like to say, is what Rashi means when he says that once they sensed that the bondage was beginning, their hearts and their minds became closed up. They didn't see clearly. They didn't see the truth clearly. They stopped seeing the point of the mitzvah of Bris Milah. The point of the mitzvah of Bris Milah was to keep them separate from the Egyptians. But because of the fear that they had from the oncoming exile, they became confused. Their perception was unclear because of their nerves and their fears, and because of that, they didn't see things clearly. They saw things wrong. They figured by covering up the Bris Milah, they could become closer to the Egyptians. That was their mistake, because of the fact that could bring them closer to the Egyptians. That would cause a greater possibility of assimilation. Therefore, Therefore, Hashem turned the heart of the Egyptians against them. But the idea that the Shibud, the Tzaras HaShibud, the distress of the Shibud, caused their hearts and their minds to be closed up, it means it clouded their vision and understanding to realize that what they were going to do by covering the Bris Milah was a mistake. That's one way of learning it. Rav Tzion Salomon explains this in a different way. He explains it that we find this word, that as Rashi says, the parsha is stuma. The parsha is closed up. Closed up. So he learns that there's another place that we find the idea of closed up. And that is Moshe Rabbeinu, before he died, he said, Moshe Rabbeinu realized, let me read it to you from here. Moshe Rabbeinu said before he died, Parshas Vayelach, Loi uchal oig latzeis v'lavoy. I am no more able to go out and come in and bring in. Shereitzera loimar, the Gemara says, what does he mean I can't go out and come in? What does that mean? B'divrei Torah. I can no more go out and come in. I can no more, so to speak, lead the teaching of Torah. Shenistabu mimenu m'seiris mayonas ha-chachma. Because at that point in time, Moshe Rabbeinu realized that the wellsprings of wisdom were now shut, were now closed down. The wellsprings of wisdom that Hashem gave him in his lifetime, they stopped. They closed up. So Rav Matisyahu Solomon says, when we're saying Parsha Zustuma, this Parsha is closed, it's trying to bring out that same idea. The closing of the Torah here means to bring out that there was a closing of Torah. Once Yaakov Avinu died, there was a closing of Torah. What was that closing of Torah that came about through Yaakov Avinu's death? When Yaakov Avinu died, the Jewish people realized the Egyptian bondage was about to begin. That caused them distress. And when you're under stress, you can't learn Torah as well. It takes away your ability to learn Torah. So the Torah is alluding to this idea that the closing of the parsha the closing of the Torah before Parshas Vayechi, the closing of the Torah that leads into Yaakov's death, is to bring out the idea that Yaakov's death brought about a closing of the Torah. And a closing of the Torah that came about, why with Yaakov's death? Because with Yaakov's death, the Jewish people realized the enslavement was coming, and with that anxiety, that took away their ability to study Torah properly. And he brings out this point from the Rambam. The Rambam in Hilchas Malachim, when the Rambam talks about the coming of Mashiach, the Rambam writes famously, Loinis Abu Achachamavanaviyam Yemaisa Mashiach, the prophets and the wise men desired the days of Mashiach, did not desire, Loi Kadesh Tu'al Kol Ha'olam, not so the Jewish people will rule over the entire world, Loi Kadesh Yeredu Ba'akum, and not so that they should be able to rule over the idol worshippers, and not so that the other nations of the world should lift them up and hold them in high esteem, and not in order to eat and drink and to be happy, so that they should now be free to study Torah and its wisdom, and there'll be no disturbance without you taking them away. When we're in Galus, we are never fully at peace. There is always something that's disturbing us. And therefore, and what is it disturbing us from primarily? From the study of Torah. And the ability to understand Torah at its highest level. So the Chacham and the Nevi'im, when they desire the days of Mashiach, they desired it because then there'll be nothing to disturb us. We'll be open and free and undisturbed from studying Torah. And the Rambam continues when he writes, U'ba'isa azman, and during the time of Mashiach, lo yasham lo yirav lo yimochama, there will be no famine, no war, nor jealousy or competition. There'll be Torah will be flowing everywhere. There'll be much Torah being able to be studied. And also, plenty of good things of life will be plenty also. The only thing the world will be involved in is to know God. And because of that, the Jewish people become very wise and know all the hidden concepts. Meaning, there'll be plenty in the days of Mashiach. But not because now, great, there'll be lots of food, we can have anything that we want. Ma'adanim etzuyim, the fact there'll be plenty of everything, means to say, everything in the world will be in order, and there'll be nothing that you have to do other than try to recognize God. And for the Jewish people, that means to study Torah at undisturbed, peaceful, and be able to delve and understand the greatest secrets of the Torah. This is what Rabbi Matzil Solomon says is what is the pshat in when it says that their eyes and their hearts became closed up. It means the same thing like a mitzvah Moshe Rabbeinu. Closed up means they no more had the wellsprings of Torah flowing. Those wellsprings were closed up. Why? Because the anxiety of the oncoming Shibud disturbed their ability to learn Torah properly. And that's what's being alluded to in the closing up of the Torah before Parashas Vayechi, leading to the death of Yaakov. Yaakov's death called the Jewish people to have their hearts and minds, that should have been open for studying Torah, now became closed up and disturbed because of the oncoming enslavement.
Does that affect the years from then until now? You look at Spain in 1992, do you think God felt we were assimilating?
There are those who write that.
Europe and so
there are those who write that.
Sort of like now. Nothing's forever.
Okay. Let's now continue. Okay. Page 292, Parak Aleph, Parak Aleph Pasuk Ches, chapter 1, verse 8. Vayakam, actually, let's go back to verse 7. Ubnei Yisrael Parayav Yishvatsu Vayibu Matzvah B'mei Ma'id. The Jewish people were fruitful, they swarmed, they increased, and they became very strong. But to Melaharetz Isam, the earth became filled with them. Vayakam Elochadash Al Mitzrayim, a new king arose over Egypt, Asher Lo Yada Es Yosef, who did not know of Yosef. Okay? How is it possible for a new king not to know of Yosef? Or what does it mean? What's the connection? Are we talking about a brand new king? Or are we talking about an old king who adopted new ways? So Rashi brings that, it seems this is an argument in the Gemara. Rabbi Shmuel, the sage Rabbi Shmuel argued, Chadamar Chadash Mamash, one said he was a new king, V'chadamar Shnez Chachuk Zeyreis, and the other one says his decrees became new. Either he was brand new, or his ways became new. Asher Lo Yada, he didn't know Yosef. Asa Atzmi Kilo Lo Yada, we mean he didn't know Yosef. Yosef was in the history books? You didn't know Yosef? Says Rashi. He made himself like he didn't know Yosef. Okay, that's how Rashi approaches it. The Sefornu has a really fascinating explanation, and the Sefornu connects this Pasuk Ches to Pasuk Zayin. It's a continuation. And the Sefornu says like this. Pasuk Zayin read, and the Jewish people became fruitful, Vayishritzu. The word Sheretz means a swarming creature. Vayishritzu, and they became like shrutzim. They became like swarming creatures. What is that supposed to mean? So one way of interpreting that means they multiplied like swarming creatures, right? Bugs and things like that multiply very quickly. So it means to say that they multiply very quickly. They had multiple births. The Sefornu says, no, para vayishritzu means that they became fruitful, and they became like shrutzim. They became, so to speak, the Torah says about eating shrutzim, it's an abomination. The Pasuk says, Yosef and all that generation died. After that generation died, the Pasuk says, the Bnei Yisrael multiplied by Yishritzu. That means, says the Sefornu, after that entire generation died, Natu Ladarche Shrutzim. They became like shrutzim. They became like swarming creatures. They became abominations. Okay. Uvachain. And what follows that? A new king arose over Egypt who didn't know Yosef. What does that mean? Right? Yosef's in the history books. You can't forget Yosef. He's there in the history books. All the more so, right? Yosef was the one who initiated that everything belongs to Paro. So you can't forget Yosef like that. Nonetheless, now these are the words of the Sefernu. The new king just couldn't believe, could not consider the possibility that he was from this nation. And that with this it should have been worthy of favor to the nation because of him. The way the Sephardim says is the new king looks at these people and he says, these can't be the ancestors, this can't be the family of Yosef. They don't act anything like Yosef. They're like Shratzim. Yosef was a tzaddik. Everybody knows what kind of great and righteous person Yosef was. These are his ancestors, these are his descendants. The wording of the Sephardim sounds like he couldn't believe that it's possible that these should be his descendants, that because of that he should show favor to them. Now, I don't know if that... Now, again, I find it a little bit difficult. Like, he couldn't believe that it was them. I mean, it didn't take much to find out that they were from Yosef's family. So, if we maybe just fix up the words a little bit, the Sephardim just means to say, looking at... He knew about Yosef, what Yosef accomplished, but looking at Yosef's descendants and seeing how far in their behavior was from Yosef's behavior, he says, they don't deserve any kind of special treatment because of Yosef. They're nothing like Yosef. They don't act like Yosef.
He didn't eat Yosef. Maybe he projected their behavior back on Yosef.
I don't know about that. My father told me that
he was such a tzaddik because his children.
Look, they probably did
it for himself.
No, maybe. But whatever it is, the way he says it is, the way the Sephardim says it is, he's saying it's from the king's point. So again, the king's point will either be that he just couldn't believe it. You know, maybe Yosef was ancient history, you know, ancient history of sorts, ancient history for ancient Egypt. At the same time, okay, he could check up into it, but like, you know, really? They don't resemble Yosef in any way. Or it means that because they didn't resemble Yosef, he didn't feel that they deserved to be treated well on his behalf. That's how the Sephardim learns what's going on here. Sephardim learns, again, is it a new king? He doesn't get specifically into the new king, right? But he seems to be saying, even if it's a new king, they should know of Yosef. He's in the history books. He did a lot of good things for Egypt. So whoever this king is can be even a new king. Why would that mean he shouldn't know Yosef? He should know Yosef, but not knowing Yosef, according to the Sephardim, means that he didn't know or he wouldn't know. He wouldn't accept the fact, right? He didn't know of Yosef means he wouldn't accept the fact that these were the descendants of Yosef that were worthy of favor because of what Yosef did for the country. That's an interesting explanation of the Sephardim. Now, Rav Hirsch has a very fascinating explanation going through, starting from Pasuk Zion, verse 7 through verse 12. I don't know if we can have all the time to get through it, but let's see how much we can get through. So the first thing, so Rav Hirsch's explanation here of the new king coming over Egypt and making the plans against the Jewish people and addressing his nation and saying, you know, we got to be careful of these people. He really explains this in a way that really is the first anti-Semitic decrees against the Jewish people. That's how he explains it. And he starts up saying the Pasuk Zion that reads, Bnei Yisrael were fruitful and they swarmed and they became many. He says, if you read the Pasuk as is, doesn't say anything negative about them. The Pasuk, in its basic interpretation, means Bnei Yisrael became as fruitful as swarming creatures. They had multiple births. Typically, when you have multiple births, what happens? The children either don't make it. When you have, because the more births at a time, the weaker the children are, the more sickly the children are. And therefore, really, if they're by Yishritzu, the fact that they are having multiple births, having so many children at one time, is not really a reason for them to really multiply or to become strong. The Pasuk says, still, Paro by Yishritzu, they multiplied and they swarmed. And still, Vayirbu Vayatzmim Emoed, still, they multiplied and they became very strong. Not only they survived, they lived. Not only did they live as weak, as sickly, but they were strong. Vatimelei Haaretz Eisem. The land became filled with them. Which land? He says, it's talking about Goshen. Goshen was where they lived, right? The Egyptians wanted the Bnei Yisrael, you know, not in their neighborhood, put them in their own little ghetto, put them in their own neighborhood, let them be there with their sheep and their shepherds and all that stuff, let them stay there. But the point is, though, that the more the Jewish people increased, the more the land of Goshen became filled with them. So far, nothing seems to be wrong. Then, he continues, V'yakam el chadash al Mitzrayim asher lo yada es Yosef. A new king arose who didn't know of Yosef. Now, he begins right away with the question, what does it mean that he didn't know of Yosef? How is it possible he doesn't know of Yosef? You know, if what's happening here is that somehow or another you've got the same king, but he has a change of heart against the Jewish people, right? That's the new king, meaning he's ready to accept the possible way of explaining new king as new king. Oh, sorry, back up. You know what a new king could mean very simply? The old king died, a new king came. That's a new king. V'yakam el chadash, a new king came. The old king died. Junior took over. He's a new king. But then the pasuk says, "Asher lo yada es Yosef." Didn't know Yosef. How can you not know Yosef? It's part of the history. He knows them. Therefore, says Rav Hirsch, and Rav Hirsch seems to be following one of the pshatim of the Gemara, but he points it out from the wording, "Vayakam melech chadash al Mitzrayim." To be raised over means by force. You would not use the phrase raised over if it just meant that, you know, the line was continuing. But it means that a foreign power, it was a new dynasty. The country was now conquered by a whole new people, a whole new leader, a whole new nationality. And therefore, there, Asher lo yada es Yosef. Yitzhak doesn't know Yosef. And maybe he doesn't care much about Yosef. It's you know, that's old history, that's part of the old history, you know, things are new now. Okay? So Asher lo yada es Yosef, he didn't know Yosef. Now, the people knew of Yosef, right? Because the people there, they're the same people living there before. There's just now there's this new ruler, he doesn't know of Yosef. Right, they were conquered. He didn't know of Yosef. Alright. So what does this new king do? He says to his nation, "Behold, Am b'nei Yisrael rav atzumimenu." The Jewish people are numerous and mightier than us. That is how you would simply translate it. Numerous and mightier than us, says Rav Hirsch. That can't be pshat, because there were not more Jews than Egyptians. They just weren't, right? The Egyptians were the people of the land. The Jews were in one neighborhood, right? There are not more Jews than Egyptians. They just weren't. So what does it mean, Rav Atzumimenu? So he wants to say two explanations. One explanation is that actually this new king, right, wherever he came from, okay? So the Egyptians that are in Egypt, he has them subjugated. So Rav Hirsch says, but he brought along people with him. He brought along his people. He set up his people in Egypt, okay? All right? So now, the way Rav Hirsch seems to be saying it is, he turns to his people, right? The people he brought, his people that he brought along to live here. And he says to them, look, the Egyptians we conquered. We're not going to worry about them.
Elamo,
right? To his people, right? His people would mean his people. He says, the Egyptians, we don't got to worry about. But you know, there's a place called Goshen. There's a bunch of people there called Bnei Yisrael. Okay? They are Rav Atzamimenu. There's more of them than us. And that's not good. We can't have them more than us. That's one way he explains it. And then he explains it, then he offers another explanation. What it means is like this. When it says he said to his nation, it means he addressed everyone. But he wants to say that the country of Egypt was a caste system. The whole country was broken up in groups, in castes. And one of the castes was Bnei Yisrael. So Rav Atzamimenu, right, doesn't mean stronger than all of us, but it means similar to what you find when Avimelech, when Yitzchak was talking to Avimelech, and he said, "Leich me'imanu ki atzamti mimenu." Leave here because you are stronger than us. You're stronger than us. It means to say, you became more rich than any one of us. And that's not tolerable. So here too, there are more non-Bnei Yisrael than Bnei Yisrael. But as a group, But as groups go, they are becoming the largest group. And that we can't allow that. That can't happen. It cannot happen that these Bnei Yisrael are going to be Rav Atzim Mimenu. They should be more and stronger than each one of us. They should not become the caste that's the strongest caste. That can't be. All right? Now, Havan Ischak Malay, he says, okay. Now he points out here is something that I want to read to you. He says, note in general, this first anti-Semitism was not brought about by anything bad that the Jews had done. There's no indication that they did anything wrong. Paro could not bring any accusation against them. Otherwise, he would not have been driven to act against them covertly, b'chachma, right? It says, Havan is chachmalay, let's outsmart them. We've got to do this smart. We need to do this smart, right? If they're troublemakers and they're making problems, we don't need any excuse. Go get them. They're making problems. The answer is, they were fine, up and respected and abiding citizens, Egyptian citizens. Jewishly, the Medrash says something else. The prophet Yechezkel also implied that spiritually, Jewishly, so to speak, they may not have been where they're supposed to be. But from the point of Egyptian society, they were fine. That's number one. B, this first rishis was engineered from above, did not spring from the people. The king is the one who said it. They were incited from above. Jew hatred was a political measure which the new dynasty used to strengthen their own position of force and violence. There is little new under the sun, and historical events at large are as old as history itself. Whenever a tyrant wished to oppress a people, he liked to give them a lower class whom they could oppress, and thus be indemnified for his own oppression. Many of the Jew laws of the Middle Ages and later have to thank this policy for their origin. Similar considerations may have guided this first instigator of the first Jew laws. He wanted to compensate the Egyptian people, whom he held in oppressive subjection, by creating for their benefit a caste of pariahs on which every other caste could look down with contempt, and in comparison to imagine himself a free man. But the fact that Paro could not okay, so that's what he wants to say. He says, Paro really could not cannot find anything wrong against the Jews per se. He couldn't. But what did he have to do? He had to now, for his own political benefit, he had to now turn the Egyptians, give some kind of excuse for the Egyptians to turn and to look down upon the Bnei Yisrael. And by doing that, that would now get him, now they wouldn't look at him. The fact that he took them over and he conquered them, is oppressing them, they wouldn't think about it, because if they can oppress someone else, that kind of puts their mind on that, and they actually see themselves as free in comparison to them, in comparison to what they're going through. That was a plot, a ploy that that Paro did, and it's something that we find out through generations that different tyrants did.
Maybe
okay.
Them also.
Excuse me. Well, let's say that. But this is his approach. This is his approach. Now, what exactly did he go ahead and say to them? All right, so we have a few more minutes. Havanis Chakmaloi. Let's make a plan against them. Pen Yirbe. Let's they continue to multiply. If war will come, they'll join up with our enemies. And they'll make war against us and go up from the land. So this is the problem. What's the problem if they leave? Who cares if they leave? Let them leave.
Mm-hmm.
The answer is, they don't want them to leave. Even if they weren't enslaved yet, they don't want them to leave. The Jews definitely benefited them. And maybe they would even take more advantage of them. Okay, they're hard workers. And we'll really work them hard. They didn't want them to leave. Okay, but still, if that's so, Rav Hirsch says, Pen Yirbe, the part that says, lest they multiply, is going on, lest they multiply, and war comes, and they join our enemies, unless they multiply and leave the land. Does this all go together? Is it separate? How are we supposed to explain this? Because the Pen Yirbe, he says, from the way that Trump is, from the way the pasuk is broken up, Pen Yirbe, lest they multiply, is going on the whole pasuk that says they'll join up and they'll go up. Now they don't want them to go up, right? So what are they saying? They will. So what's the connection between, so lest they multiply and leave, right? So, but they don't want that to happen, right? And where does the war part come in? It has nothing to do with war, right? Pen Yirbe, maybe they'll become multiply and decide to leave. We don't want them to leave. And where does the war, so how does the war part fit in? So he says that you could actually learn it as two separate things. Pen Yerubah, lest they become, they keep multiplying. And number one, if a war comes, they'll join up with the enemy and we'll be in trouble. That's one problem if they get, if they keep multiplying. The second problem if they keep multiplying is va'ala min ha'aretz, they'll go up from the land. Okay? What land are they going to go up from? What's the connection between them? Become more and go up from the land? They're just going to decide to leave? We see a reason for them to leave? So he explains that leave doesn't mean leave Egypt. Leave means to leave Goshen. The more they increase, the more they increase and the more they can't stay in Goshen, the more they're going to come moving to our neighborhoods. We don't want the Jews in our neighborhoods. We don't want them in our neighborhoods. We don't want them spreading all over. They want to stay in Goshen, let them stay in Goshen. But not to spread all over? So this is all the way Paro is trying to incite the people. The people have nothing against, from first learns, the people had nothing against, the Egyptians has nothing against Bnei Yisrael, there's nothing against them. But for his political gains, he had to start inciting against them. So he said, look, people, we got a problem. We have a problem. Look, number one, this Bnei Yisrael, they're not making any problems for us, but you know what? These Jews, if an enemy comes, they'll join up with the enemy. We can't trust them, number one. And number two, you know what keeps happening if they keep getting more? They're going to start breaking out of their neighborhood and coming into ours. And that doesn't, and that shouldn't happen. That shouldn't happen. And therefore, we got to do something to decrease their multiplying. And that's where the plan of the slavery came in. But if Hirsch has a really, it's a fascinating way of approaching this whole explanation, this whole part of the parsha, in which basically he shows that there's nothing new under the sun. All the same kinds of things that generation, that history, we see how history turns on the Jews through in many countries, it all, and with certain types of claims and certain types of excuses and leaders trying to turn the people against the Jews for their own political gain, that already started in Mitzrayim.